This is the Artisan CEO Podcast, a bonus episode. On this episode, I will be sharing our experience of adoption with our first son. So our two boys, Felix and Teddy, both of them joined our family through the gift of adoption, and both of them have really different stories in terms of how that process went. So I wanted to devote one episode to each of our boys' stories in order to do those stories justice. So this is our adoption journey, part one. Welcome to the Artisan CEO, where the art of photography meets the business of profits. This is where strategy and craftsmanship coexist so that you can run a creative business that supports a life you love. I'm your host, Abby Grace, and I promise to give it to you straight. I started sharing about our infertility journey back in 2016. And if you want to hear that full story, just go on over to season 3 bonus episode, because I did share our journey of infertility up until the point that we decided on adoption. So we'll link to that in the show notes. So because we'd been sharing about our infertility journey, once we decided to go the adoption route, it only made sense to me to share that as well, because at the outset, adoption felt like this huge black hole of information. I had no idea what went into adopting other than the fact that I heard it takes a long time and it was really expensive. And I think that being the only information I had to go off of, I didn't really consider it as a viable option as early as maybe we could have. When we got married, Matt and I had the, I feel like it's pretty standard conversation, like, hey, if we aren't able to have kids, like, would you be open to adoption? Yes, great, me too, fantastic. And that was the extent of that conversation until we started walking the road of infertility and realizing that this might actually be a reality for us. But I also know that God's timing is perfect. And so the fact that we didn't pursue it earlier on in our journey wasn't a mistake. And that things unfolded exactly as they were meant to, when they were meant to. So a couple of key terms you're going to hear me use throughout this episode, the term expectant parent versus birth parents. This is something that our agency explained to us pretty early on, that someone is not referred to as a birth parent until after termination of parental rights has been signed. Before that, they are just an expectant parent who is considering adoption. And that reframe was really helpful for us because it helped me understand that someone who's making an adoption plan, that's a tenuous plan. And it is not, nothing is final until paperwork has been signed and the grace period has passed. We'll talk more about that grace period later on in this episode. But that was helpful, respectful language for us to learn to use, that once we were matched, that Felix is, now she is a birth mom. But before that, she was just an expectant mother who was considering adoption, and that our job was to love her and support her along the way. And we'll get more into that in this episode. Next term is place versus give up. That we, these days, we say that someone is placing their child for adoption. We don't say they're giving their child up for adoption anymore, just because that term placement implies the care and consideration and love that goes into an adoption decision, as opposed to giving up for adoption, which, I don't know, it just doesn't feel as respectful. So that is a term that we use that our agency was really intentional about sharing with us. There are also three different levels overall of adoption. There's open adoption, semi-open adoption, and closed adoption. Closed adoption means that you have no contact information for the birth family. They don't have any contact information for you, that no information is really exchanged at all. And that was a very common practice up until probably like 20 years ago. Most adoptions were closed adoptions. There's semi-open adoption, in which some identifying information might be exchanged. There might even be like updates given. So like parents provide updates to the agency and the agency provides those updates to the birth family, pictures, like milestones, that kind of thing. And then there's open adoption, in which sometimes you have direct contact information for each other, like a phone number, and you can text photos and videos of the child. You might even meet up with the birth family, the open adoption was presented to us with our first meeting with our agency as the standard that most of their families go with. And I was very intimidated by that. But we have come to love the open adoption that we have. We've loved the level of open communication. And just to stipulate, open adoption is not co-parenting. We are our kids' parents, but open adoption just allows us to have a little bit more free flow of information. So if you have more questions about that, you guys are welcome to send me a DM. I don't want to make a bunch of like you know, general platitudes, because every adoption story is different. And I recognize that our story with Felix is very different from our story with Teddy. And neither one of those is better than the other. And a lot of, you know, a lot of the consideration that goes into that is what's best for the child, what's best for the birth family, what's best for the adoptive family. And so those are very, very nuanced, very personal decisions that are going to change from one family to the next. But if you have questions about our experience, specifically with when it comes to open adoption, happy to share those. Please feel free to shoot me a DM about that. And then the last thing I'll say before we get into this is I will not be sharing the details of our kids' stories in terms of what brought their birth parents to adoption. Those are their stories for us to hold close until such a time as they're able to share them for themselves if they want to. We got a lot of curious questions with both of our boys, again, who have very different stories. And they were questions like, oh, do you know why his birth mom's choosing adoption? Or, oh, I guess she's pretty young. Or, oh, are the birth parents together? And I had to work really hard not to bristle at those questions because I recognize that those are coming from a place of curiosity, but they just felt like we feel very protective over our kids' stories. So we choose not to answer those questions, not because we're being secretive or because there's anything shameful to hide, but because these are our kids' origin stories and we want them to hear those first. And we want our kids to be the ones to decide if and when those stories become common knowledge or not. Matt and I are our kids' parents, but because of the nature of adoption, we will never be their birth parents. And therefore, we don't feel like the details of their birth families are for us to share far and wide. So that's something we maintain with our families. That's something we maintain with friends, with strangers who, you know, sometimes ask questions, you're like, oh, wow, that's a really personal question. We actually choose not to share that. And it's been an interesting journey in learning how to say that in a way that doesn't come across as standoffish. And I've had a lot of practice over the years. But if you've ever asked me a question about that I've given you that answer to, it's not because I'm trying to keep you at arm's length. It's because I'm trying to protect my kids' stories. So I'm going to talk about the adoption process first, pre-placement. And I'm going to answer the questions that we had when we started off and then give you an overall timing, overall idea of timing and structure and how that process unfolded with the agency that we work with. And then I'm going to share about our placement experience with our firstborn, Felix. I'm going to record a second episode about Teddy's placement experience because I have a feeling that the final runtime of this episode is going to be long enough as it is. So first question, how did you decide on adoption? So like I detail in season 3 bonus episode about our infertility story, we walked the road of infertility for a few years before we started realizing that this was going to take something beyond just basic fertility treatments that you can get with like a normal OB. And so we had two routes available that we were considering. There was the IVF route, and then there was the adoption route. And we met with a fertility clinic about the IVF route, but there was just something, things never seemed to line up. We never felt peace about going that route. The finances didn't line up. And so as we were on this kind of holding pattern of like, well, let's see if we can save. And because in the state of Virginia, insurance companies are not required to pay for any portion of fertility treatment. So all of it was out of pocket. So we're like, oh my gosh, we're looking at like tens of thousands of dollars here. Let's hold and do some saving. And in during that time, just didn't feel peace yet about moving forward with the IVF route. And then adoption started presenting itself more and more clearly. We had business coaches who took off, I think it was a full month, to go bring their daughter home from China. I kept reading these books that like it just popped up in the books like, oh, the author has an adoptive son, or the author was like adopted themselves. It kept presenting itself. I photographed a wedding for a college friend of mine, and the officiant at the wedding was actually one of my college ministry leaders. And I asked him like, hey, what was it that, you know, when did you and Jenny decide that it was time to pursue adoption? And he's like, why are you and Matt thinking about it? We'd love to talk with you. And it was just everywhere. And so Matt and I took that as, okay, the doors seem to be continuously opening and pointing towards adoption. And we do not feel the same thing is happening when it comes to pursuing further fertility treatments. Let's go meet with an adoption agency just to get some more information. We had actually met with an adoption agency in 2018 just to see, like, is this even something that we feel led to. And at that point in time, we were still in the middle of fertility treatments. And I just was like, I want to see where the fertility treatments go and see if that works. So we met with an agency in June of 2018. And then a year later was when we were like, okay, the signs seem to be pointing, like the Lord seems to be pointing our feet towards adoption. So we went to another meeting with, meetings with two agencies. One was a faith-based agency, and then one was a not faith-based agency. And we really, really liked the second. We didn't have a problem with the first one that we met with, but the second one we really liked. We liked that they had a larger staff. We liked that they had their own like offices. They were based in the next state over, but we decided this was the agency that we just felt like things were clicking with. So the next question, why did you choose to work with an agency? Because there are other options, other routes to adoption. You can go the route of private adoption. And we did some very basic exploration on private adoption and just felt like if we were to go with an agency that there would be more protection there for us, for the expectant parents. And so we didn't really pursue much of the private adoption route. So I can't honestly tell you much about that route other than we chose to work with an agency. And the agency that we chose to work with has a really, really high commitment to ethical standards and ethical adoptions. And not every agency out there will do that. So that is something you want to keep an eye out for. And we are really grateful to have worked with the one that we worked with. And if you want the exact name of that one, I'm happy to give it to you. Again, just shoot me a DM. They are based in Maryland and they work in the DC, Maryland, Virginia area. So if you are not in this area, I don't think they'll be able to help you, but happy to share that name on a one-on-one basis. Then the next question was, how did you choose domestic infant adoption? Because there are other types of adoption out there. There is international adoption. There is domestic older child adoption. There's foster care. There are so many different options. And I will just say that we went with domestic infant adoption because we really wanted to be parents to a baby. And the international door was actually closed for us. We applied. So the agency that we worked with does do international adoptions. And so we applied for, we weren't sure which one we wanted to do. So we applied for both the, I think it was South Korea option, as well as domestic infant. And the door was closed for us for South Korea because I have ADHD. And so they take mental health into consideration. And apparently ADHD is a disqualifying factor, which is okay because that was a choice that we weren't sure which one we wanted to go with. And that was the Lord closing a door for us. So that was okay. We're like, great. All signs are pointing towards domestic infant adoption. Okay, so how long did the process take? So we had our initial meeting with the agency that we went with in early July, and then we sent in our application a few days later, and I think we were on vacation actually while we sent in our application, and then when we got back from vacation, we had our initial intake meeting, and I think that was in early August. So it was like a 2 or 3 hour meeting where they explain, here's the basic rundown of how this goes, here's what you can expect, what questions do you have, and I had so many questions and I learned so much in that initial meeting and it started to break down some assumptions that I had made. I was very grateful. They were really patient with us during that meeting. So we had our initial intake meeting in August of 2018, I guess that was. So maybe we met with our first agency in June of 2017. Yeah, it must have been June 2017. And then it took us another year to decide that this was the route that we were going. So we had the intake meeting in August of 2018, and then Felix was born the following August. So it was about 13 months from beginning to when Felix was placed in our arms. And that timeline is not necessarily typical. I will talk a little bit more about that coming up. So what was the first step? It wasn't even really a first step. It was more like the information gathering process where we decided, do we want to take the first step? And it was attending those informational meetings with two different agencies. And we really liked that the agency we eventually went with specified that they were about finding families for children, not finding children for families. And that's a subtle distinction, but I think it's a really important one. And we'll talk a little bit more about that when it comes to the questions that we asked the agencies that we eventually worked with. And we just really appreciated that high commitment to ethics was on display from the get-go. So once we decided on an agency, we applied to work with them. And then when we were accepted, our official step one was that intake meeting where they answered all of our questions, and we had a lot. And then they handed us a stack of paperwork in a manila envelope that was about an inch thick, and they walked through all of that paperwork with us. And to give you an example of some of the things that were inside that paperwork, there was a personal health history. So we had to go get a new physical with our doctor and have extra blood work run and then have all of that submitted to the agency. There was a financial history, financial details that they want to make sure that you are able to provide for a child that's coming into your home. We had to get life insurance, which was something I'd been meaning to do for a while, but hadn't done because it required blood work. And I really don't like needles. So we got life insurance, provided history of that, or provided proof of that. They wanted to know our family history, not just in terms of health history, but also in terms of relationships. We had to write a personal biography. I think there was a page requirement for that. I can't remember. Mine ended up being like 8 pages long. It's just like, here is my entire life story. They wanted to know your emergency home plan. So you provide like a blueprint of your house. And in the event of a fire, here's what will happen. Details about your home, making sure, you know, it's not under active construction, that kind of thing. There was a lot more paperwork. Matt did the majority of the paperwork, which I'm really grateful for. And then I handled the profile book, which I will talk a little bit more about in a couple of minutes. So once we filled out all of that paperwork, and I asked our agency, I was like, what's the record for like the fastest time that anyone's gotten this done? And they said 1 weekend. And I was like, oh yeah, we're definitely not going to beat that. I think it took us like 2 or 3 months because we got our first call from our social worker in December. So yeah, it was like I think it took us about 3 months to get all of that paperwork finished up. You can do it faster than we did, but it just took a little while. We were also in the middle of wedding season at that point. So after all of the paperwork was submitted, then we had our home study. And in the state of Virginia, that is 4 meetings. The first meeting was with both Matt and I, where we talked about our story, our relationship dynamics. And then each of us had a separate interview. So I had one by myself with a social worker, and Matt had one by himself with a social worker. And then we had a fourth and final meeting together where we finished up talking about like our relationship and our hopes for parenting and how we anticipated parenting, parenting styles, that kind of thing. The social worker had a lot of questions about like, well, have you considered this? And it was just like those meetings are like 2 or 3 hours each. And it feels very invasive at the time. You're sharing a lot of personal details. And that fourth and final meeting was at our house, where they also did a safety inspection of our home to make sure, again, there's no like open construction going on, that you have evacuation plans, 2 points of exit for every room. If you've ever been to someone's home and they have a fire extinguisher on each level, they are either very responsible, fire safety aware adults, or they've been through the adoption process, and I trust you will know which one applies to your friends. So it took about a month for the final home study to be written, because once you've got all 4 of those interviews, and they typically take place like 1 per week for 4 weeks, once those are done, then your social worker, well, our social worker, our agency, wrote up this like 30-page report. And that took about a month for the final home study to be written, because they're cross-referencing with all of your paperwork that you submitted, all of the notes that they took during their interviews with you. And so that final home study is written up, and then it's sent to you for fact-checking. So you do get to read what is inside that. It's an interesting read. And that home study is what certifies your family to be able to adopt. It shows the state that the agency has done their due diligence to ensure that that child is being, whatever child ends up coming into your home, that they are being placed in a caring, loving, safe, and stable home. And again, it feels invasive, like incredibly invasive. But because adoption always begins with trauma, it is all that more important for agencies to protect children who are coming into adoptive families to make sure that it is as stable and loving of an environment as possible. It's how it was explained to us, and made total sense once they, because I was like, this is a lot of personal detail that you're asking for. Is this necessary? And they're like, yes, because that trauma of separation, like that is significant. And so when we place a baby or a child into a home with an adoptive family, we want to make sure as much as we can that we're not placing them into an environment that is likely to inflict even more trauma on top of what's already come about as a result of adoption. So once you are home study approved, so we had our first home study meeting in January. So just to keep up with the timeline, we had our intake meeting in August and we started our paperwork. We actually started our paperwork exactly 1 year to the day before Felix was born. I looked back on that. That was fun. So we started our paperwork in August. We turned it in November. We had our first home study meeting in January, and then we were home study approved. We had a little bit of a delay in our process due to some unforeseen circumstances, but we were eventually home study approved. I think it was the end of April. So then what happens after you're home study approved is you need to choose a placement agency, and you can choose what's called an in-area agency that works in your geographical area or an out-of-area agency. I interviewed 5 to 6, and the one that you choose is going to be based on your personal preferences, maybe availability within area agencies. We were able to work in area with one agency during Felix's adoption process, but their wait list was full when we wanted to go for round two with what ended up being Teddy. And so some of that depends on their availability, your preferences, their preferences. So I interviewed 5 to 6 agencies throughout the East Coast and the Midwest. And I had a series of questions that I asked that would help me gauge their commitment to above board ethical adoptions. I wanted to know their position on birth parent care. And I also asked about their fee structure. So for anybody who's interested in those questions, what I asked was, what sort of post-adoption services and support do you offer for your birth parents? That was a clue to me as to how much effort an agency puts into caring for expectant parents before a placement. Some of the agencies that I talked to seemed kind of thrown off by that question, which made me think that, honestly, that they were more focused on transactions with adoptive families than on caring for and counseling expectant parents in a time of crisis. Second question I asked was, at what point do you offer expectant parents the opportunity to choose a family? Personally, we wanted to wait to be chosen until an expectant mother was further along in her pregnancy. Some of the agencies that we spoke with said that they allowed expectant parents to choose as early as 12 weeks. And for us, that just felt really early. So much can change in someone's heart and in someone's situation over the next 28 weeks of a pregnancy. So we just wanted to make sure that agencies were giving parents the pre-adoption counseling option, and then helping them explore their options and consider the situation from all the angles before we became involved. I also asked, how many waiting families do you typically have at any given time? It was just a good number to have on hand if they're like, oh, and then the second question to that was, how many matches do you typically see per year? Because if they're like, well, we have 180 waiting families on our list and we only do 4 matches per year, then like, I mean, we never saw numbers as egregious as that. But it just helped me to gauge like, okay, if you're at the max end of what you can handle and you're seeing fewer adoptions, like that list probably isn't going to turn over very quickly, and we may be waiting for a very, very long time. Then we also asked, how do you choose which families to present to an expectant parent? Because some of them will say, some of the agencies will say they prioritize based on who's been waiting the longest, which is totally understandable. And then other agencies will handpick a few profile options that they feel like the expectant parents would really like to see. And it was just good background information to have. And then 2 other questions we asked was, what is your fee structure like? Because we wanted to look for an agency that did not require a large lump sum upfront. I spoke with a few agencies that charged hefty listing fees. And one of them we talked to was like, this is our listing fee and also our advertising fee. And I was like, that feels weird. Not wrong, but just, I don't know, something about that felt strange to me. And then those agencies would also charge another lump sum upon matching. And so our personal comfort zone, and again, this is our story, your story might be totally different, your comfort zone might be totally different, but ours was, we wanted to work with an agency that required a smaller fee to list, and then potentially a larger fee at matching, just because that was what made us feel comfortable. And then the follow-up question to that was, what happens to payments made in the event of a fall through? Because that is a very real possibility. We experienced one of those. You guys will hear that in part 2 of our story. Because if an agency told me, hey, if you have a fall through, we're going to keep all of your match fee, and don't worry, we'll apply it to the next one. For me, that just, it was based on guidance I had received from another adoptive parent that like, that's a little bit of a, not a warning sign, but just, okay, well, if you're keeping my match fee, like, is there incentive for us to be matched again? That's not to say that an agency doesn't have an incentive to match you again, because I don't want to make any sweeping assumptions without having worked with an agency, but it just felt like, well, if you've kept this sum of money from us, what's the incentive for us to be matched again when you could just match a new family? And like that, there have been families who were matched once and then never got matched again because there was no incentive for the agency. So again, this is not meant to like throw shade on any particular agency. it's just things to think through, you know, questions to ask that you don't know to ask. That I was very fortunate that our agency that we did end up working with was the same one we did our home study with, and that they were like, hey, here are some questions that you might want to consider asking based on your personal preferences and the level of risk that you're comfortable with. So a lot of it really just, it comes down to risk, like how much emotional risk are you willing to take? How much financial risk are you willing to take? So we ended up choosing to list with two agencies. We worked with the one that we did our home study with, that one in Maryland that we really liked. And then there was also an agency in Florida that I really liked. And so we decided to list with both of them, which means we were placed on their waiting families list. It's called Going Active. And so we worked with two agencies to increase our chances of being seen. And again, that just is, that comes down to personal preference. It also comes down to financial, because there's a fee to list with an agency. And so financially, like, what kind of risk are you willing to take? So then the next question was, how do expectant parents choose a family? That depends on the agency and on the expectant parents, on their preferences. So some agencies will present families, hopeful adoptive families, who've been waiting the longest, who also fit with what the expectant parents are looking for. Some agencies don't necessarily take wait time into as much of consideration. And then some expectant parents choose to defer the decision to the agency's social workers. When choosing, expectant parents are presented with a profile book that tells the story of your family. Matt and I always said it's kind of like an eHarmony account, but like in print of your family's story. And it shows what life looks like with you. It gives a glimpse into your home life, your love story, maybe what brought you to the adoption table. And I knew from the beginning that I wanted to work with Kindred Co., who helps you design your profile book to be both visually pleasing and, more importantly, thoughtful and considerate in how it's written. I was really, Matt handled most of the paperwork. I almost exclusively handled the profile book because I was excited about it. It you know, required me pulling a bunch of photos from like several years of our love story, which was really fun. But I loved working with Hannah of Kindred Co. The adoption process as a whole taught me a lot about my own self-centeredness. And one of the pivotal moments for that growth came when we were working on what's called the hello letter that sits right at the front of your profile book. And that letter is a chance to speak directly to the expectant parents who are looking through your book, to acknowledge the difficult decision that they are considering, and to tell them that you see them and you see their love for their unborn child. So when we first came to the adoption conversation, I was very much focused on what we wanted, which was to become parents. But the more that we learned with the workshops and the classes that we took along the way with our agency, because that's part of the paperwork process too, is fulfilling a certain number of educational hours. And the more we learned, the more I realized that adoption is not primarily about us. It is about a child who, due to whatever circumstance their story originates from, it's a child who is in need of a home and a family who's going to care for them and love them as their own flesh and blood. And it is about a parent or parents who are facing what is likely one of the most agonizing decisions of their lives. And I had made some harsh assumptions about what might bring somebody to the adoption table as an expectant parent, eventually a birth parent. But I learned along the way, so grateful we learned that so many birth families are acting from a place of love and tenderness and care for their child, and that no matter the situation, it was never my place to do anything other than pray and act in love and be the hands and feet of Jesus to any of these expectant parents that we had the privilege of interacting with. So when we wrote that letter at the beginning of the profile book, it was not a marketing pitch. It wasn't like, here's why you should choose us. It was just a way for us to say, we recognize that this is really hard, and no matter what, we are in your corner and we're praying for you. So we had that profile book that we prepared. We were working on that during the home study process. So once we went live, we sent copies of that profile book to both of the agencies that we were working with. And I think both of them wanted both digital and physical copies, and we ordered those through like Blurb or something. So that was the adoption process pre-placement. So now it's time for our match and our placement story with Felix. And being matched means that you have been chosen. Sometimes this happens pre-birth. So, hey, you've been matched with an expectant mom who is X number of weeks pregnant. Sometimes it happens right after birth. Sometimes it happens a few weeks after birth. So that match process for us, we were told at the beginning, okay, you're a live waiting family, you're on the list, you can be chosen at any time, but heads up, it's probably going to take you 12 to 18 months to be chosen. That is the average wait time for a new family. So we were prepared for that. I didn't think it was going to take quite that long. I just had a hunch it was probably going to happen earlier. But what I didn't anticipate was being chosen after 13 days of being live. We got the call 2 days after, 2 days after Felix's birth parents chose us. And I was like sitting in our dining room. I don't even think I gotten dressed for the day. I was like still wearing my bathrobe. And I got a call and I looked at my phone and it was the pregnancy counselor from our agency. And I was like, oh my gosh, I feel like there's probably only one reason why she'd be calling. So we picked up and she told us, she was like, this is very fast. This was very fast. She said that multiple times on the call. But she said, you have been matched with an expectant mom who is 30 weeks pregnant and it's a boy. She's due at the end of August. She's healthy. Baby's healthy. She's local. She's pretty close to where you guys are. She didn't tell us where she lived, but she said that she wants you to be at the hospital when he's born. She wants you guys to be there from the very beginning. And she would also like to meet you beforehand sometime in the next few weeks. And I mean, it was just this like the world stopped and we were like, what? Like it's been 2 weeks since we went live. This doesn't track with what you guys told. Like it just was so, I mean, imagine getting like a positive pregnancy test when you've been waiting for a long time. Like this was kind of that, I guess. I don't even know how to describe it. So we like immediately called our families. In hindsight, I'm like, man, I wish we'd like, I don't know, done something fun and recorded their reaction, but we were just so like over the, just not even knowing what we're feeling, calling our families, telling them. One of my favorite things was calling my best friend because she was pregnant after they'd been trying for the same amount of time that we had for a family. And she was pregnant and due August 19th. And Felix's due date was August 21st. And I was like, hey, when was your due date again? She was like, August 19th. And I was like, great, because we've just been matched and baby's due 2 days after that. So that was really fun. And then when you add to that, I think it was like a week or two later, we were talking with the pregnancy counselor again. She was just giving us an update. And she told us, I was like, oh, by the way, do you know where M is delivering? And she said, yeah, it's at the hospital down the street from you. And this was the same hospital that I had been in a couple months earlier and had cried walking through those hallways, passing the labor and delivery this way signs, because I knew that I was never going to need to go to that hospital for a birth. And then the Lord, it was just one of those moments where I was like, God sees me so clearly. Like he orchestrated this. He planned this. This is so redemptive in a way that I never could have written. So the thing to know about being matched is that is a very tentative place, a very tentative place to be. Like I said, we called Felix's birth mama M for expectant mama. That's how I'm going to refer to her from here. M was making an adoption plan. But we held that news with completely open hands. We knew she could change her mind at any point up until 10 days after the birth. So when adoption paperwork, placement paperwork is signed, it's called termination of parental rights. And each, this is going to vary from state to state, but there is a period of revocation. I think all states have the period of revocation. I only have experience with Virginia and Florida, but in Virginia, when someone signs termination of parental rights, they have 10 days from the time the baby was born to change their mind. If they were to sign that paperwork, let's say 2 weeks after baby was born, then they have a 7-day period. I think that's how it works. But because Felix's birth mom signed paperwork at the hospital, it was a 10-day period from when he was born until when she was able to change her mind. And we supported that. We supported her right to decide what was best for her son, whether that was parenting him or placing him in our arms and in our home. So in order to protect our hearts from becoming too attached to this sweet boy who wasn't ours yet, not that we didn't want to be vulnerable, but we just wanted to make sure that we weren't feeling like we were entitled to the role of parent when we were not. So in order to protect our hearts from becoming too attached to a sweet boy who was not ours yet, and in order to not put any pressure on M as she carried him and prepared for his birth, and as she made an adoption plan, we learned to refer to baby as simply Baby Spring. We had the name Felix picked out. We actually ran that name by her. We were like, hey, we're thinking about naming him Felix. This is the middle name that we're thinking of. And she actually chose a middle name. So he has two middle names, and one of those was given to him by his birth mom. But we did not call him Baby Felix because, again, he was not our son yet. So that period of waiting ended up being about 10 and a half weeks. She was a few days late. She went a few days past her due date. That was one of the most unique periods of time I have ever experienced. I look back on my prayer journal entries from that, and I'm like, I felt like we were living in this state of suspended animation. Like, we couldn't plan anything past the end of August when baby was due, but we also held that hope of becoming parents so loosely, and we knew it wasn't a sure thing. And I've never leaned on the Lord like I did during that period of waiting, because there was no other way that I could make it through the day. There was so much potential for fear and anxiety of like, but what if this all falls apart? And so I just leaned completely on the Lord, asking him to protect Em and to protect baby Spring. Specifically remember praying like, God, protect her emotionally, mentally, physically, and spiritually, and praying the same thing for baby Spring, of asking God to show us how to love them both well, and asking him to protect my heart and to keep my eyes on Jesus. I was highly aware of how much pain might be waiting for us on the other side if Em decided to parent instead of placing baby for adoption. But I knew that if that happened, then that baby was never meant to be ours to begin with. And keeping her pain in mind, the agony of the decision that she was considering, the lengths that she had gone to protect this sweet boy as he grew in her womb, that made loving her so easy. Because at the end of the day, her need for love and support took a higher priority than my desire to be a parent. And Matt and I decided from the beginning that we were going to love them both for as long as we had the opportunity. So if that meant just for the next 10 weeks, and then she ended up parenting instead of placing, then that was what our role was supposed to be. If she placed baby with us, then that meant a lifetime of being able to love them both. And our job during that wait was to be faithful and act as God called us to act, and to trust wholly in the perfection of his plan, whether we understood how things ended up or not. We ended up having the opportunity to meet with Em twice before her due date, both times with the pregnancy counselor in attendance. And I'm so grateful for those meetings. We were really nervous walking into those because we didn't want her to feel like we were talking at her belly, like we were only there for her child. We wanted her to know that we cared about her, and we wanted to know how she was doing. And those meetings were incredible. We got to learn more about Em. We learned about her childhood and her upbringing and her hopes and her family and her dreams and her likes and dislikes, even her pregnancy cravings. She brought a sonogram to the first one, which was so cool. And eventually we asked about her hopes for the birth and for her hospital experience. And so by the time the delivery day came along, it didn't feel like we were strangers, which is exactly what she had expressed a hope for, and what an answer to prayer that ended up being. So when we walked into the hospital, it didn't feel like strangers walking in. So fast forward to the end of August, and we got a call at 2:20 a.m. on Sunday at the end of August, and I knew that as soon as the phone rang that it was going to be go time. My pregnancy counselor, I was like, there's no other reason she would be calling at 2:20 in the morning. There's no reason anyone would be calling at 2:20 in the morning. So our pregnancy counselor told us that Em had been having contractions all night, and we'd been kept up to date, like, you know, especially as she was getting past her due date, like, how's she doing? How's she feeling? We didn't have any direct contact with her. All of that was through the pregnancy counselor, just to mean that separation and make sure that she had space, that Em had space to consider and plan as she wanted to without feeling pressure from us. And so pregnancy counselor told us that Em had been having contractions all night. She'd been admitted to the hospital, and that we would get another call once she was situated and was okay with us heading over. So we got up, we got ready, we checked our bags for the last time, and then we sat on our hands for the next few hours until I think we tried to go back to sleep. And I was like, who am I kidding? There's no chance I'm going to be able to fall back asleep after that. And so we got another call around 6 a.m. telling us it's okay for us to head on over to the hospital, that she was ready to see us. So we stopped at a Starbucks along the way, and I told the barista, I might become a mom today, which I'm sure was very confusing to him because I did not look pregnant, because I wasn't. But I was like, I don't need to explain the nuances of the story. I just need you to know I'm really excited. So we arrived at the hospital. We took one last selfie of just the two of us before we headed in. And then we went to meet Em on the labor and delivery floor. And I wish that I could explain in more precise words just how precious and almost sacred that time felt in the hospital. Her best friend was also there. Em's best friend was also there, and we got to spend hours like talking, and I think we watched some sort of reality TV show. I can't remember what it was. I got to learn more about her and just more about her story. And when the pregnancy counselor arrived from the agency, we played this ridiculous game with making balloons out of like hospital latex gloves. And Em was so kind. I had asked her this at our second meeting, if she might be okay with me having my camera with her, not to take photos of her, any kind of identifying photos, just that if the, like, would she be okay with that? And she knew I was a photographer, and she said, yes, that was totally fine, that was very, very gracious of her. And Emily Gerald, our newborn photographer, she arrived around 2 or 3 p.m. and she waited in the lobby with Matt as he and I swapped out, just to give Em some space at points throughout the day. I think she napped at one or two points. And then Emily Gerald was there to photograph if and when we had the opportunity to meet baby after he arrived. And Em's nursing staff during the day were amazing. I cannot say enough about how kind they were, especially in what I'm sure was not a typical labor and delivery situation. It's crazy. That day, it like feels like a blur, but there's also the moments that stand out in sharp contrast of like, oh, put a pin in those. Those are incredible. Like, I got to pray over Em when things felt overwhelming or when her labor stalled. I cannot express what an honor that was just to be there in the room with her during such an intimate process of any woman's life. That was such a privilege. I was so honored that she trusted me to be there for that, someone that she'd only known for a few weeks. And throughout the day, she showed selflessness and courage like I have never seen. She constantly put others before herself. She fiercely loved her sweet boy throughout her entire pregnancy. And she gave us more consideration as hopeful adoptive parents than we had any right to expect. I wish everybody could meet her to see for yourself what an incredible and strong and gracious person that she is. So we got there at 6 a.m. and Felix made his debut late that night after just 20 minutes of pushing, which I'm told is incredible. Like, normally you push for longer than that. And because Em had asked me to be there as one of her two support people, I got to be in the room to hear Felix's first cries, which, oh my gosh, again, it was a gift we never expected to be given. And our agency kept repeating over and over again, like, this is not typical. Like, you are having, like, this is, you're being given all of these considerations that a lot of families never given. Like, we just want you to understand and appreciate what a privilege this is. And we did. So after making sure that Em felt okay with me popping out, I ran to the waiting room and shouted, "He's here," at Matt and Emily. And then I ran back into the delivery room while the nurses attended to Em and cleaned up Felix and weighed him and all of those things, checked his vitals. And about 20 minutes later, they escorted Felix over to the room next door where Matt and I had the opportunity to officially meet him and to hold him and to give his first bottle. And I am more grateful than I can say that Emily Gerald was there with us with her camera to capture it all. I'll link to a blog post in the show notes that I wrote after Felix was born so you can see some of my favorites. Those photos are so precious to us. The hospital was incredibly accommodating to us and gave us a room on the mother and baby floor so that we could stay with Felix until he was ready to be discharged. Our agency made sure that we knew not to expect that because it was going to be completely dependent on Em's comfort level, but then also what the hospital had room for. But we ended up staying for two nights with Felix, rooming in with us. And then when Felix was released, he was sent home directly with us. And that was another gift that we were not expecting. Again, with that 10-day grace window, the revocation period, that means that Em had until day 10, the end of day 10, after Felix was born, to change her mind, which, again, we completely supported, even though it felt honestly really scary at the time. We had to keep reminding ourselves that what she was facing was even heavier and even more significant, and that if baby was supposed to be a springman, he would be. And if she changed her mind, then he was never ours to begin with. So in order to help protect all parties involved, our agency's typical recommendation is that baby should go to what's called cradle care, which is interim foster care with a third party family who, like, that's all they do is they have babies in their home for this interim period. And bless those people to have a never, like, to ha- I mean, gosh, that is a calling for sure. So the purpose of that during cradle care during the revocation period would be to give Em space to think and consider her options without feeling the pressure of knowing that, like, baby was already home with us. And then also to give us a buffer in case Em changed her mind so that we wouldn't feel the pain of more separation than was necessary. Again, every adoption is different and every expectant parent's story is different. And hopeful adoptive families also have different wishes too. We know a family who wanted to wait until the end of that revocation period before they met baby. There are several different considerations to take into account. What is the agency's recommendation? what is or are the expectant parents' wishes? That's the most significant factor. And then thirdly on that list, what are the hopeful adoptive parents' preferences? And that one definitely falls last on that list, what we, the hopeful adoptive parents, wanted. And it's not to say that what we wanted didn't matter, but it was definitely the third tier consideration because, again, it's not our child yet. It's a expectant parents making a plan for adoption, which may or may not be followed through on. And so our preferences in that situation were third, and that was okay with us. And we knew that going into it. So our agency recommended cradle care for Felix, but she expressed a desire for him to be, this is a decision, a final decision she made at the hospital, was that she wanted him to be discharged directly into our care from the hospital. And that was our preference as well, but that was completely her decision, and it was not something we would have asked for. And so when she told us that he was going to be coming home with us instead of going to cradle care, that was just another prayer answered. We got to walk out of that hospital with Felix in our car seat, put him in our car, bring him home, and introduce him to our families. And all of that was done with the knowledge that there was still time for Em to change her mind. But we had peace about that because we knew that whatever the Lord's plan was, that he was going to walk with us through that. He never calls you somewhere that he is not also going to walk with you. So during that 10-day period, we kept completely off of social media. We didn't tell anybody but our family and our close friends that Felix was here because we didn't want to place any kind of pressure on Em. If she were, for example, to like see an announcement on Instagram, that could be construed as coercion, that like you're putting pressure on her publicly to not change her mind. So we were just advised, don't put anything anywhere, and we wouldn't have anyway. But once day 10 had passed, I think it was on day 11, we told the world that baby Spring was here, and we celebrated with our wider circles, our church family, our bigger groups of friends and families, just celebrating what God had done. So every state is different, but in Virginia, you have to wait until, I think it's after your third post-placement visit with a social worker in order to file for adoption finalization, and that tends to be around the 6-month mark, because I think we had a meeting, like our social worker came to the home at 1 month, 3 months, and 5 months. And then the final report, I think, is put together by around the 6-month mark. So we filed for finalization in February or March and received the final approval from the courts that Felix had officially been grafted into the Springman family at the end of June when Felix was about 10 months old. And that time, those months between the end of the revocation period and adoption finalization, those are not as up in the air as the revocation period was. You're not spending 10 months like, you know, on pins and needles, like, oh my gosh, is something going to change? Something really drastic would have had to have happened in order to remove Felix from our care at that point. So the post-placement visits with our social worker were more like check-ins, just how's everybody doing? How are his pediatrician visits going? Is he gaining weight properly? Do you guys need any additional support? That kind of thing. And then all of those details from those post-placement visits were written into a report that was submitted by our lawyer to the courts, the Virginia courts, with the request for adoption finalization. And then once that came through, we were able to apply for Felix's new birth certificate, which then allowed us to get a social security card and apply for a passport and all that. And that was technically the conclusion of our experience for our first adoption process. It wasn't the end of the adoption conversation. That is something that we talk about regularly in our home and with our kids. But as for interactions with our agency and with the state, that was the end of it. And that's a lot. I'm looking at my timestamp. You guys will hear a shorter version of this, but without edits so far, we're at 55 minutes. And I blogged my way through the process the first time through, but putting this all into one episode feels a little bit overwhelming because I'm not doing it in chunks. It's just one big story. So if you or someone that you know is considering adoption or you're walking the path right now, I hope that this was educational and encouraging. If it was, please send me a DM to know that, like, this helped maybe one person, hopefully. I'll say nothing has cracked my heart open like this experience, both times through with Felix and Teddy. And I cannot imagine where we would be or who I would be if we hadn't walked this road and seen all that the Lord had planned for us here. Our boys are the biggest gifts to us, and their unique stories are such a testament to God's faithfulness to heal what is broken and to make beauty out of ashes. Adoption is hard. It is not the rosy picture that some people might like to paint it with. And that doesn't mean that adoption isn't beautiful, but it is not this picture perfect everybody is, oh, it's only a happy thing because adoption always starts with trauma. So in order to be an adoptive family, it means that separation occurred in somebody else's family. And no matter the circumstances behind that separation, that there will be pain and questions and healing that we're going to hold space for. We know that as our boys get older, we are not going to have all of the answers for them. So we keep those doors open for conversation, and we speak positively and lovingly of our kids' first families, and we pray for their birth families by name every night at bedtime so that our kids are accustomed to hearing about their adoption. I think one of the things our agency said was, if your child is old enough to remember being told that they were adopted, you waited too long. So that's something that's been part of the conversation from the beginning, during bedtime prayers with them. And Matt and I pray for wisdom as their parents to shepherd their hearts, for wisdom to steward their stories in a way that glorifies God but doesn't gloss over the messy and the hard part. So if this episode encouraged you, or you know someone who's considering starting down the path of adoption, please share this with them. I don't stand to gain anything from this, but I tell our story again so that it demystifies what can feel like a very overwhelming process. Thank you for sticking with me during what was a very non-traditional episode of the Artisan CEO podcast.
If you did, remember to hit subscribe so you don't miss an episode.
Our adoption journey,
and head over to abbygrace.co/podcast
with the road to our second son,
Blow Your Clients Away at Your Very Next Branch.
And involved,
I'm Abby Grace, and I'll see you next time.
Now,
match,
let's go get after it, shall we?
In a completely different version of Beauty Coming from Ashes, and I cannot wait to share that with you.